KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump deployed the National Guard to Los Angeles amid protests of his immigration raids. We'll hear from one L.A. area congresswoman, Nanette Barragan, about how her community is reacting. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. All this week, NPR has stories about living on a hotter planet. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Today, we'll hear about how we can build homes and communities to be more resilient to climate change and reduce emissions. Also, U.S. cabinet members meet today with Chinese officials to negotiate over the trade war. What can be accomplished without President Trump and President Xi? And Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports explains how his sports podcast turned political. It's Monday, June 9th. On this day in 1934, Donald Duck's cartoon debut is released. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Los Angeles police have declared the city's downtown area off limits. There were growing clashes over the weekend between protesters and federal immigration agents after sweeping immigration raids last Friday. Now, President Trump has deployed hundreds of members of the National Guard to L.A. California Governor Gavin Newsom says Trump did it without his cooperation. Speaking to MSNBC last night, Governor Newsom says he will sue.
Well, I mean, look, Donald Trump has created the conditions you see on your TV tonight. He's exacerbated the conditions. He's, lit the proverbial match. He's putting fuel on this fire ever since he announced he was taking over the National Guard. An illegal act, an immoral act, an unconstitutional act, and we're going to test that theory with a lawsuit tomorrow.
Trump has hinted that he will watch what happens in other cities besides Los Angeles. The president has seemed to allude to the possibility that he could send in troops to other cities. Ukraine's Air Force says Russian forces launched one of their largest strikes on Ukraine overnight since the war started. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv. Russia has recently stepped up attacks to retaliate against a Ukrainian operation that damaged Russian bomber planes.
There were no reported casualties in the strike despite its scale. Ukraine says Russia attacked using nearly 500 drones and missiles. Air Force spokesman Yuri Ignat said most were shot down by Ukraine's air defense. Ignat says Russia targeted one of Ukraine's military airfields in the latest attack. Last week, Ukraine says it used small drones hidden in trucks to hit dozens of Russian military aircraft, including bombers, in airfields as far away as Siberia. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he expects more retaliatory attacks from Russia and is urging Ukrainians to heed air raid warnings. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News. Kyiv.
Trade officials from the U.S. and China are in London today for a fresh round of trade negotiations. These will include tariffs imposed by both countries that caused global trade to stall in April. The meeting comes after President Trump spoke with Chinese President Xi last week. NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab has more.
Three of President Trump's top trade officials are in London for talks with senior Chinese officials. Chinese Vice Premier He Lefeng will represent Beijing. The last time the two sides gathered for talks in Geneva last month, the two countries agreed to a 90-day lowering of tariffs. This put a pause on the more than 100% tariffs each country had levied on the other. But relations have since taken a turn for the worse. Both sides accuse the other of violating the Geneva deal, and world leaders and investors will be watching to see if talks in London can help diffuse tensions between the world's two biggest economies. Fatima Al-Kassab, NPR News, London.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 100 points. This is NPR. President Trump's travel ban has taken effect. Citizens from 12 countries cannot travel to the U.S. Citizens from another seven nations are under a partial travel ban, and their entry will be restricted. Trump claims he will use this power to keep terrorists out of the United States. A judge's ruling has found that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting board members, whom President Trump wanted to fire, can stay on the job. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, it's the latest development in a multi-front battle between the administration and public broadcasting.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting funnels about $500 million a year to public television and radio outlets. The president is seeking to curtail its independence. One way he's doing that is by trying to fire three of its five board members. The CPB is privately incorporated as a not-for-profit in D.C. and asked the court to rule Trump did not have the authority to fire them. U.S. District Court Judge Randolph Moss wrote Sunday he wasn't convinced a judicial decree was necessary. Moss said changes to CPB bylaws meant board members could not be fired by Trump. NPR and PBS are suing Trump over his effort to compel the CPB and local stations to withhold all funds from the networks. Trump has also asked Congress to claw back $1.1 billion over the next 2 years for public broadcasting. The House could vote on that this week. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
In the NBA championships, the Oklahoma Thunder beat the Indiana Pacers last night to tie their series at one game each. In Pro Hockey Stanley Cup Final, the Edmonton Oilers and the Florida Panthers are also tied at one game each. The NHL Game 3 championship is tonight. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, a judge in Massachusetts accused of helping undocumented migrants escape federal agents is fighting to keep her job. First, though, we go to Los Angeles, where anger over President Trump's mass deportation campaign has boiled over.
Yeah, for 3 days, protesters have taken to the streets of L.A. in response to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, immigration raids. The president, in an extraordinary move, deployed the state's National Guard against the wishes of California Governor Gavin Newsom. Local and state officials are accusing the president of purposely provoking chaos.
With us now is NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. So how do these clashes between authorities and protesters escalate so quickly?
Well, they started on Friday when immigration agents carried out raids at a Home Depot and at some downtown L.A. warehouses and began rounding up immigrant workers. People who heard it was happening showed up and tried to stop these arrests. They yelled at agents. They tried to block their cars. They threw rocks as they sped away. And as video of these confrontations spread, top Trump administration officials and the president himself went on social media and on TV and started attacking these protesters for interfering with ICE. On Saturday, after more of these scattered confrontations, President Trump issued a proclamation calling the protests rebellion. He invoked a rarely used presidential authority to federalize the California National Guard and said that he would bring 2,000 of its troops into L.A. to protect ICE agents. And those troops started arriving yesterday.
Okay, and where did things go from there?
Well, the protests started to grow larger. Yesterday, things started peacefully. Large crowds gathered in downtown L.A. to protest the ICE raids. Rosa Cesaretti was one of them.
We cannot stay home when this kind of thing is going on because it's always, they say, first it's them and then it's you.
As the day went on, though, things got more chaotic. Federal and local law enforcement used flashbangs, tear gas, and rubber bullets to disperse the crowds, protesters threw cinder blocks and set a couple of cars on fire. Police arrested dozens of people, including some who blocked a freeway.
Now, the governor and the mayor of L.A. are blaming the president for this unrest. What are they saying?
Well, they say that Trump wants chaos and that he's instigating violence to justify a crackdown. Governor Gavin Newsom and L.A. Mayor Karen Bass said they had things under control and that Trump's decision to take over California's National Guard is only inflaming things. The last time, that a president deployed a state's National Guard troops without a request from the governor was 60 years ago. Governor Newsom called it a breach of state sovereignty. Yesterday, some of the first troops to arrive in L.A. were stationed at the entrances to various federal buildings. This is what Mayor Bass said at a press conference yesterday.
I join with the governor in appealing to the administration to rescind the order to federalize the National Guard and allow the National Guard to come back under the control of the governor.
Now, Governor Newsom said that he is suing the president over this. The president's order says the troops will be deployed for 60 days or as long as the Secretary of Defense thinks it's necessary.
All right, so that's what the governor and LA's mayor are saying to the president. What are they saying to their constituents who are out there protesting ICE?
Well, all day yesterday, they were pleading with them to remain calm and peaceful. Newsom asked people not to take the president's bait, not to give him an excuse to crack down. Trump officials say they are charging ahead with their deportation plans. So a big question going into this week is whether these protests and the federal government's response will continue to escalate.
All right, that's NPR's Adrian Florido. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
For more on the protests and the response of elected officials, we reached out to Democratic Congresswoman Annette Barragan, who represents California's 44th Congressional District. That includes the city of Paramount, just south of Los Angeles, where protests against immigration enforcement actions flared up over the weekend. Congresswoman, what have you heard from your constituents about how these protests were handled and how things unfolded?
Well, we're hearing that there's a lot of fear in the community, whether they're next, whether ICE is going to come for them. And so that, you know, is something we're getting lots of calls about. We heard calls yesterday in San Pedro that there were sites of the National Guard. But frankly, people are outraged about ICE being in our community. I think it's completely unnecessary that the National Guard is there. I completely agree with the governor that this is it's there to inflame the situation and to make things worse. And it's exactly what has happened. I also want to point out that, you know, I agree that today, actually, there's three things happening in Los Angeles. We need people to remain peaceful. Those causing damage to the city and to assaulting officers are not welcome. We, you know, continue to condemn any violence. So today, when they go out, please keep that in mind. This is a movement against immigration enforcement. In particular, it's about protesting mass deportations and what they're doing. There's no targeted effort here to find criminals, like they said they were going to do. They're sweeping up friends and neighbors and people who are just trying to find jobs at these work sites outside of Home Depot.
You mentioned the National Guard. President Trump's proclamation says that the National Guard troops will play a supporting role by protecting ICE officers rather than have these National Guard troops perform law enforcement work. So in these kinds of situations when things tend to get tense, why wouldn't local police welcome those kinds of reinforcements?
Well, local police, they can make sure that the public is safe and they can protect federal officers. That's the whole point of there's no need to call in the National Guard. Actually, they did that in Paramount when they came to Paramount on Saturday morning. It was the sheriffs who got things under control, not the National Guard. In downtown LA that night, it was the LAPD who got things under control. It was not the National Guard. You bring out the National Guard, you rise tensions, people come out, and this is what you're starting to see happen. It's exactly what this president wanted.
Yeah, the National Guard has only been deployed to protect federal buildings. They wouldn't have been in Paramount. So what would be the problem with just having them do that, have their duties confined to those things?
Well, people feel, again, that it's unnecessary. They feel this is the administration taking over, and it is. This is the sign of a dictator who takes over a National Guard against the governor's will, against all elected officials' will. The presence of the National Guard in itself is sending that message. We're here to take you over. We're here to, this is to empower the president to flex his muscle. So people have seen that, and we've heard some reports of people being, attacking and throwing things at National Guard. It's for that reason. Now, any violence is unacceptable, completely unacceptable. But they're not needed, and so it's only inflaming the situation, and that's the whole point, is People want ICE and they want the National Guard out of our communities. There is a way to do enforcement. It's targeted enforcement. It's been done over and over again and hasn't resulted in this. This is really a distraction.
You said that you were told that California should expect 30 days of ICE enforcement. Are you thinking that we might see 27 more days of what we've seen over the last 3 days?
Well, from what the federal officials have said, it's going to continue. And I could see why, because right now the president's, all of his policies are failing. The economy's tanking. He's about to take health care away from millions of people. Prices are going up. And so this is a way to deflect and go right back to a signature issue. Let's go back to immigration and let's go after California. We saw that happening starting when he's going to defund California and stop giving us federal money. Now he's taking it to the immigration front. So this is his game plan, and we can't let people fall into it. We have to make sure not to take the bait, not to do the violence.
That's Democratic Congresswoman Annette Barragan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
NPR invited Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and President Trump's border czar Tom Homan for an interview. They did not respond. We also reached out to Homeland Security Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs Tricia McLaughlin. She was not available this morning, but we will hear from her on Morning Edition later this week.
A Massachusetts judge faces judgment today. Similar to a case in Wisconsin, this judge is accused of helping an undocumented migrant slip out of her courtroom to avoid immigration enforcement agents. Criminal charges have been dropped, but now NPR's Tovia Smith reports the judge is fighting to keep her job before a judicial conduct board.
The trial-like hearing of Judge Shelley Joseph started today with a tour of that courtroom where the undocumented immigrant went out the back door to evade ICE agents waiting for him at the front door. The immigrant, who'd been deported twice before, was in court on drug charges. In 2019, the judge would end up facing charges of her own, conspiracy and obstruction of justice, federal crimes that could have meant years in prison.
From certain quarters, I've heard the occasional gasp of dismay or outrage.
Andrew Lelling, then U.S. attorney during Trump's first administration, acknowledged the seriousness of the charges at the time, but denied they were politically motivated. Rather, he said it was the judge's personal views that led her to violate the law.
We don't get to pick and choose the federal laws that we follow. That is a crime. It makes no difference to me if the federal laws involved are immigration laws, drug laws, tax laws, or anything else.
Joseph and her attorney declined to comment, but she has denied any wrongdoing, insisting she knew nothing about any plan to evade the ICE agents. In legal filings, she says she was wrongly accused by her alleged co-conspirator so he could get an immunity deal for himself. But Shelley's big break came when the Biden administration dropped the charges and let the matter be settled instead by Massachusetts Commission on Judicial Conduct. Geraldine Hines, a former state Supreme Court justice, says the commission, not the court, is the appropriate place to handle a case like this.
We don't stand over judges and question them about why did you decide this. We don't do that.
This case is not about a judge obstructing ICE, Hines says. It's about ICE undermining what is supposed to be an independent state judiciary.
That's the authority that we give them. You know, judges temper justice with mercy, and we have to give them space to make those kind of hard decisions.
The commission's proceedings will unfold like a trial with testimony and cross-examination that could go on for a week or so. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, comedian Otsko Okotska is known for finding humor in the dysfunction of her immigrant family and the daily responsibilities of being an adult. Her new stand-up special is about her father, who reappeared in her life after decades away. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Officials from the U.S. and China are in London today for a new round of negotiations on the tariffs between the two countries that caused global trade to sink in April. The meeting comes after President Trump spoke with Chinese President Xi last week, their first known call since Trump started the latest trade war. NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab joins us now from London. So what can we expect to happen today?
So three of President Trump's top team are here, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, and Trade Representative Jameson Greer. And from the Chinese side, China's foreign ministry confirmed over the weekend that Vice Premier He Lifeng will be representing Beijing. Trump, in a post on his social media platform last week, said the meeting should go very well. And this is the second round of talks between the two countries. The last time they got together for talks was in Geneva last month. And today's talks will continue negotiations between the world's two biggest economies on a tariff war that's really rocked global markets.
So was there any progress the last time the negotiators got together?
Yeah, so the last talks in Geneva led to a 90-day lowering of tariffs. That put a pause on the more than 100% tariffs that each side was charging the other on various goods, which had more or less wiped out most trade between them both. President Trump declared the talks in Geneva a success. He said they were a total reset of U.S.-China relations, although tariffs are still about 30% higher than his pauses on other countries' tariffs. Relations have since taken a bit of a turn for the worse. Both sides accuse the other of violating the agreement that they came to in Geneva, and there have been disputes since. China halted its exports of rare earth minerals. They're vital to car makers and other industries, although President Trump did say last week that President Xi had agreed to let them flow once again to the US. So we might learn more about that during this meeting. And there's also been issues around things like visas for Chinese students at American universities. I spoke to Yu Jia. She's senior research fellow on China at the international affairs think tank Chatham House. And she told me how she would describe relations between the two.
If it is only one word that we'll be able to describe, will be in stalemate. So I think that sense of stalemate relationship will continue even after the trade talk of this week.
And Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who's been leading the negotiations, recently acknowledged that the talks had stalled and said it would be up to the two leaders of the two countries to get them back on track.
Right, so what happens next?
So while it's good news that these talks are happening at all, analysts say we shouldn't hold our breath to expect any major progress. Yu Jia from Chatham House told me there's still very little convergence between the two sides and what they both want.
I think they're quite far apart, but also this largely depends on how much pressure that United States can handle and how much pressure that China can handle. Because essentially, Beijing is using the exact same playbook as Donald Trump, giving the maximum pressure to your opponents.
So it's unlikely we'll get any further tariff reductions from either side, she says. But there may be some progress around some of those key sticking points, things like the rare earth exports. And China, for its part, would like more access to high-end U.S. computer chips. The U.S. had suspended sales of some of that advanced technology to China, including things like semiconductors. So there may be some progress on these points. These are both two very tough negotiators, so it's still unclear whether they'll reach a breakthrough.
That's NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab in London. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
6 months ago, wildfires destroyed entire communities in Los Angeles.
The fires were a clear reminder of how climate change is increasingly affecting where we live. That's why all this week, NPR will be bringing you climate solutions related to housing.
Joining me now is NPR's Julia Simon to explain more. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, Layla.
Okay, Julia, summer, love the weather, but it's also a season of fires and hurricanes and heat waves, and that can get people pretty worried, pretty scared. So what is this week going to offer them?
As climate journalists, we're always asking ourselves, how can we build our homes and communities to be more resilient to climate change? And how can we reduce climate pollution? Because, Layla, there are hopeful stories out there. And that's what this week is all about. Not being Pollyanna-ish, but sharing stories about real housing solutions from reporters across the U.S. and the world.
Which can be really useful. I'm guessing some of these solution stories involve preparing for upcoming disasters.
Yes, we're going to Alabama to look at fortifying roofs for hurricanes, to New Jersey to look at elevating homes for flooding. Solutions don't just involve actions individuals take. Researchers find communities can take preventative measures too, together. So we have a story from Colorado where many people worked to make multiple homes buffer against wildfires. Here's Lisa Hughes of Louisville, Colorado.
By you doing it and your neighbors doing it, you're making your community safer.
So community-wide climate actions is right. Clearly a theme here.
Definitely. And we have stories from Nevada and Utah about addressing heat and drought in desert communities, again, all together.
But these solutions are not just about adapting to climate change. There are solutions about reducing the emissions that heat the planet.
100%. Housing is a big source of climate pollution, Layla, whether that's building materials that use lots of planet-heating fossil fuels or energy-intensive heating or cooling. So we have stories about making housing more sustainable. We actually have tips to help you use less electricity in your homes, like this window shade.
It's like a curtain outside of your window.
Obviously, it makes sense because the heat doesn't go in. It stays out.
Exactly.
And that Austrian voice you just heard was Sebastian Schublach. He's a resident of Vienna. Most of the stories are from across the U.S., but we do have a few exciting solutions from Europe. Ultimately, we hope people will come out of this week, Layla, feeling empowered and knowing a lot more about housing climate solutions that are already taking place.
That's NPR's climate solutions correspondent, Julia Simon. You can check out our climate solution reporting all this week and find more stories at npr.org/climateweek. And you'll hear a lot of those stories from Julia. Thank you.
Thank you, Layla.
Support for NPR's Climate Solutions Week, Rethinking Home, comes from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR.
This is NPR News.
It's no secret that it's hard to find water in the desert.
The math problem is all the water has been used, it's been called for, but yet we have one of the fastest growing communities in the Western United States.
One community in Utah is hoping to solve that problem with sewage. I'm Ari Shapiro. That story and more on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Los Angeles area is bracing for more protests and clashes with law enforcement over the Trump administration's sweeping immigration policies. California Governor Gavin Newsom says on social media the state's ready to sue President Trump over the National Guard deployment over the weekend. He and other Democrats accuse the administration of stoking unrest. Democratic Representative Nanette Bergun, who represents California's 44th congressional district, spoke with NPR.
People feel it's unnecessary. They feel this is the administration taking over, and it is. This is the sign of a dictator who takes over a National Guard against the governor's will, against all elected officials' will.
Confrontations erupted when activists gathered outside a federal detention center to demand the release of dozens of people detained by ICE agents on Friday. It touched off a weekend of protests, and Trump deployed the National Guard without the governor's request. President Trump's travel ban takes effect today. Citizens from at least a dozen countries, mainly in Africa, the Middle East, and South America, are affected. At Newark Airport, Haitian American Elvanice Luigi says she's worried about Haitians trying to escape dangers at home.
I don't think it's a good thing. I think it's very upsetting to see and hear.
President Trump says the ban's a response to terrorist attacks on U.S. interests. The Dow's down nearly 100 points. The Nasdaq is up 56. You're listening to NPR News. Voters in Italy are deciding on a referendum involving labor rights and whether it should be easier to obtain Italian citizenship. NPR's Ruth Turlock has more from Rome.
Referendums have long been an important part of Italy's democratic process, but this one on worker rights and on the important question of how quickly immigrants can get Italian citizenship will likely be rendered invalid because not enough people have come out to vote. Italy's right-wing government opposes the changes being proposed in this referendum, which was brought by labour unions and left-wing parties. And instead of engaging in the democratic process by campaigning for a no vote, politicians in the government have been telling supporters to boycott it. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
The Venice Film Festival plans to present a Golden Lion for Lifetime Achievement to Kim Novak. The 92-year-old retired actor became a box office star in the 1950s for her performances in a number of classics, including her dual role opposite actor James Stewart in the Alfred Hitchcock thriller Vertigo.
There's someone within me, and she says I must die. Buscari, don't let me go.
The Venice Film Festival also plans to premiere the documentary Kim Novak's Vertigo by Alexander Philippe. The festival starts in late August and runs through early September. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At Uma.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Our next guest is Dave Portnoy. And if you're surprised to hear the founder of Barstool Sports on this news program, so is he.
I would say I had no plans. If you told me I'd be on NPR and a political-leaning podcast like 5 years ago, I'd be like, you're crazy.
Portnoy founded a media company that features podcasts, web stories, lots of ads for gambling, and also Dave Portnoy talking about things like watching basketball star Caitlin Clark.
Because I was there for it. I was decked out. fever hat, fever sweatshirt.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I saw that.
His business model is to cover whatever guys might talk about while at a bar watching sports. That now includes politics, which he riffs about on social media.
The thing about me is when I see something and I get an opinion and it bubbles up, if I don't get it out, I just combust. I may just explode. So,
when progressives denounce his language about race or women, he says that's why men voted for President Trump.
Maybe they don't trust the extreme left like you, who seemingly hate all normal white guys.
Portnoy started Barstool just out of college in 2004 in his native Boston. It was a sports and gambling newspaper that he handed out at train stops.
And that's how it started. And that's how it was for the beginning years.
Did you have a vision for what it was going
to
be?
No vision. I just really want to wake up and enjoy what I did.
Barstool rose with the internet and with the growth of legalized sports betting. It's now a factor in gender politics. Analysts sometimes talk of Barstool conservatism, pro-Trump, libertarian, against political correctness. He's seen as part of the manosphere, social media stars appealing to bros.
I think when you say the word bro, it's somebody who, you know, maybe likes sports and wants to get laid, like, which I don't think is a bad thing at all. I think that can sometimes be like shamed. So, you know, bro, what are they thinking? Rogan, they're thinking Theo Vaughn. I get thrown in that a lot.
Do you accept it? Are you in that group?
We have a male audience. Like, we may feel very differently on certain issues. So I think if somebody says, bro, what are they saying? You love Trump. I voted for Trump. It's more an indictment of, I would say, the Democrats, an endorsement of Trump's politics. I'm pro-choice. I think people would say that is not a typical bro standpoint.
He says his politics responds in part to critics. He feuded for years with Business Insider, which published stories accusing him of sexual misconduct. Before that, critics focused on remarks about race, women, and even rape that he says were comedy.
I felt that that was something that drove me to probably be a little bit more political.
You talk about your feeling that the political left makes, I believe the phrase was, normal white guys feel like you're evil or bad or something.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah, I'd stand by that. I started a business from scratch and really didn't get any help, moved home, worked, didn't take a vacation day for 10 years and grinded my ass off to get where it is. And I felt that I should somehow have shame as being a white person who wants to make a lot of money and live a great life. And that bothered me.
Months into Trump's second term, Portnoy still supports him, although he publicly complained when Trump's tariffs sank the stock market.
I lost a lot of money, and so I'm going to rant about that. And he had a quote later that it wasn't his stock market. I think it was Biden's. Well, that's garbage. It's yours. Your direct statements are causing it to go up and down. It's bounced back. I was mad, but I told myself, it's like, he said he was going to do tariffs. That wasn't like he was hiding that and pulled it out. So for the most part, I feel like he's trying to do exactly what he ran on and what he got voted for.
In our long conversation, which you can find on video on the NPR app and on YouTube, Portnoy doesn't really defend the president against accusations of corruption.
But I don't think it's unique in a weird way, like the Trump meme coin, like that's so blatant in your face. I'd almost rather have that than like Hunter Biden doing some back deal that I don't know about. So none of it to me is good. But
it's more straightforward to just have a dinner and everybody who's paying me should come to dinner.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what Trump did with the coin.
With the coin, yeah. So again, I don't like it. And they are, I'm sure, making money. But I won't sit here and say, well, damn, like Donald Trump's the first president ever to be making money. Like I think they all do. I mm-hmm. don't trust any of them.
There's probably a lot of your readers that invested in that meme coin and have lost as it's gone up and down.
Well, yeah, meme coins is a crazy world. I actually made money on that one, but...
How'd you do that other than buy low, sell high? Was there something to it?
That's just totally it. Like, I think I bought at 24. I went to bed. It was at 75. I said, get me out of this. And then I put made a million, and I put on the Buffalo Bills to win the Super Bowl. So I'm back down to even.
Democrats, as you probably know, are asking, why are we doing so badly with men? What would you tell Democrats to do differently, if anything?
There's a lot of things, probably. It goes back to what you said, and I don't know if I have the specific example, but I really, truly feel like men have been, demonized is not the right word. I'll use an example of a story.
He talked of a time when pro football quarterback Drew Brees was on TV and told his sons, boys, you can do anything. Humphries was criticized for failing to mention his daughter.
To me, that you've lost the plot of reality. Like, not everything is nearly as serious as it may seem. And to me, like, guys can say a girl is pretty without being sexist. That doesn't make you a sexist pig. And my story probably makes me, some of the stuff I've had to deal with, I'm probably more sensitive to it. But
you're talking about accusations that you faced about harassment and
stuff. Yeah, harassment, never, and like a story that people still, like the New York Times, literally, they asked me for a quote about something the other day. I said, I'd rather put a pencil in my eye than speak to you guys.
Portnoy began talking about a social media post from years ago in which he sang a song that included the N-word. It's one of several times that he'd used it.
But if you can't look at intent on what's being used and use some rationale, that's bad. For the New York Times to literally be like, Dave's a racist because of that incident, 20 years of doing stuff, to me is wildly disingenuous.
I think you're saying, I shouldn't have said the word, but it wasn't that big a deal, or it doesn't say
everything. I would never do it again, but at different times, and even if you want to say Dave is a racist, I'm not stupid. Like, I posted this on YouTube. I didn't realize the impact that it would have on some people. I wouldn't do it again. But there is context to things. There's more texture to things. And a lot of times I feel like in this internet age, it has blown out. I mean, that clip still gets used against me. If someone doesn't like me, I hear that every time.
Does your story also suggest, though, I mean, your success suggests that things are really not that bad for guys? You've done really well in life.
Yeah, I don't know that it's bad. Do you still want to be, like, demonized for it? No. And I wouldn't say it's bad. Like, I don't know that my story, though, is an indication of anybody else's story.
Portnoy is indeed doing well. His company has launched many successful podcasts, and he likes to point out that some are hosted by women. There's more in our video interview where you can hear why this free speech advocate felt that speech about Jews in one of his bars went too far. This is NPR News.
After a devastatingly hot summer last year, Nevada is stepping up efforts to tackle urban heat islands. One solution is surprisingly simple: more trees. Next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. Last week, we told you about a zebra on the loose in Tennessee. Video showed the zebra running along the highway and strolling through neighborhoods. Residents named him Ed, and people made a lot of memes about him. One imagined him just hanging out at the Waffle House. Yesterday, Ed was caught and airlifted to a nearby animal shelter. He was found in a pasture. No idea if that was after a Waffle House pit stop. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. President Trump says his deportations prioritize immigrants who committed violent crimes. But authorities are detaining migrants who thought they were protected by a program that offers help to crime victims. Zane Irwin of the Kansas News Service has the story.
In 2022, Jose Madrid Leiva was robbed at gunpoint while pumping gas in Merriam, Kansas. The father of three already had a lot on his plate. He does not have legal status in the U.S., but what he does have is a pending application for what's called a U visa. It's a program that allows some crime victims to earn a pathway to legal status if they cooperate with law enforcement. But despite that, Immigration and Customs Enforcement took Madrid Leiva into custody after a routine traffic stop by local police in April. Speaking through an interpreter, his brother Jairo says the arrest blindsided his family.
The kids don't sleep. They have bags under their eyes and they're getting skinnier, and his wife as well. They're simply devastated.
Madrid Leiva's lawyer, Rekha Sharma Crawford, has been fighting his arrest in federal court. She says his case appears to be part of a new policy by the Trump administration to target as many categories of people as they can for deportation, not just violent offenders.
The rhetoric is, we're trying to get rid of the worst. Okay, well, people who've been victims of violent crime aren't your worst.
The U visa was launched in 2000. It's one of several programs designed to protect immigrants on humanitarian grounds. Some U visa applicants are authorized to work and receive temporary protections from deportation. Once it's granted, recipients are on track for permanent legal residency or a green card. Kathleen Bush Joseph is with the Migration Policy Institute.
Congress recognized there's a value in protecting immigrants who come forward, report crimes, and are willing to work with local police.
But federal authorities can only give out 10,000 U visas per year. That limit has left a quarter of a million migrants waiting, decades in some cases, for a final decision. Under former President Joe Biden, ICE agents were told to avoid detaining people who've applied for benefits through programs like the U visa. But in an internal memo leaked in January, ICE leadership rescinded that guidance. An ICE spokesperson responded to NPR, but he did not answer detailed questions about why the agency is arresting migrants who thought they would receive protections for cooperating with law enforcement. NPR spoke with immigration attorneys in Missouri, Florida, and Pennsylvania who are already seeing the impact this policy has on clients. Philip Weiss is co-director of legal services at the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society in Pennsylvania.
Everybody's rightfully concerned, and not only are they not applying for U visas, but these crimes that are occurring are not being reported.
Florida immigration attorney Andrew Klopman says targeting crime victims instead of perpetrators is counterproductive.
They'd rather go with the quick, easy deportation, and I don't feel that that's making society safer.
It's impossible to tell how many crimes could go unreported by survivors who fear deportation for coming forward. But hundreds of thousands of people have pending applications for U visas. People like the Madrid Leiva family, who are now unsure what their futures hold as the administration continues to go after programs that once protected migrants. For NPR News, I'm Zane Irwin in Kansas City, Missouri.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Today is one of the biggest days of the year for Apple followers. Its annual developer conference kicks off. Now, in previous years, the company has used the event to introduce new stuff, things like operating systems, microchips, and even its virtual reality goggles. And this year, people are watching to see if Apple can follow up on some ambitious promises it made last year on artificial intelligence. Now, just a note, Apple is a financial supporter of NPR. NPR's John Ruich is here to tell us more about all this. John, so what exactly is this event?
This is the once-a-year WWDC, or Worldwide Developer Conference. It's an event aimed at software developers, mostly the people who make apps for Apple or partner with the company. It's also a forum, like you said, where they introduce new products. Most, though, are going to be on the software side.
Okay, so last year, the big announcement had to do with artificial intelligence. What did Apple say it was working on?
Well, Apple jumped on the AI bandwagon in a big way with a product that it calls Apple Intelligence. It was supposed to do a bunch of things. One of the big things people were watching out for was that it was supposed to make the virtual assistant Siri a lot more interactive and useful and just generally smarter about your individual context. So, for instance, it could access your emails and pictures and text messages, help you find things in them, and help you do things with that info.
All right. So how did that pan out?
Well, the company a few months ago said that it has made improvements to Siri, but a lot of those AI-enabled features that they talked about aren't quite here yet and are going to take longer than expected to deliver. Patrick McGee is a reporter with the Financial Times who just published a book about Apple. He says this is a big problem for Apple, especially at a time when AI is taking the tech industry by storm.
It's hard to be too hyperbolic about the significance of what AI will be in the next few years. And I'm not even sure Apple's in the top five. Maybe they're in the top 10. I mean, for the world's most valuable company, basically since 2011, they're doing a remarkably poor job in keeping up, let alone leading.
Wow, that was a bit of a surprise there. So beyond artificial intelligence, where else is Apple maybe facing some pressure?
Well, they're facing pressure on a lot of fronts. Tariffs is a big one. There are, of course, tariffs on countries where Apple manufactures, like China. But also, President Trump has singled the company out. He's explicitly said he told Apple CEO Tim Cook that he expects iPhones to be made here in America, or else he'll impose a tariff of 25% on them. Apple's run into regulatory hurdles, both in the U.S. and Europe, mostly around its App Store. So it faces challenges, a lot of challenges at once on different fronts. In terms of getting AI right, Apple did take a credibility hit, and it needs to be seen to be less flat-footed on AI. But Carolina Milanesi, who's a tech analyst at a firm called Creative Strategies, says Apple is not out of the game by a long shot.
The AI race, as much as we like to talk about it as a race, is a marathon, and is a marathon that changes pace very quickly, pretty much on a monthly basis.
She says Apple's had great success with products that the company wasn't necessarily the first to bring to market. It came later, but it had a better product, and it's got a really loyal customer base on top of that. At the event, we may hear more about Apple's plans with AI. Apple watchers are also expecting the next version of Apple's operating system to drop with a fresh design. And there are reports about possible upgrades to AirPod earbuds being announced. Apple has declined to comment on what to expect today, more on the criticism, so we're going to have to wait and see.
All right, that's NPR's John Ruich. John, thanks.
You're welcome.
A group raising awareness for hostages held by Hamas held its regular weekly march in Boulder, Colorado on Sunday. They held it exactly 1 week after an attack against members of the group. Rachel Cohen from the Mountain West News Bureau has the story.
On many Sundays since he moved to Boulder 6 months ago, Alon Dagan and his young family have walked with the local chapter of Run for Their Lives. The organization calls attention to the hostages still held by Hamas. It felt like they'd found their community.
Seeing people walk, being a part of the walks, really made us feel like we didn't have to hide.
But that changed after a firebombing attack last week. Federal authorities charged Mohammed Sabri Salomon in an attack that injured 15 people. They say he shouted Free Palestine and threw Molotov cocktails at peaceful demonstrators. Salomon faces a host of state and federal charges, including attempted murder and a hate crime. Dagan and his family were out of the country when the attack happened and the texts started pouring in.
I mean, first thing is to kind of, who was there? Are they okay? And then just sort of this shock of just coming to terms with the fact that this type of hate, unfortunately, has spread to so many corners of the world that it's really hard to feel safe.
But he says the tragedy has also brought people together. Organizers say about 15,000 people gathered in downtown Boulder Sunday. It also happened to be the city's 30th annual Jewish festival.
We're not going to let even something so terrible take away our pride, our ability to persevere and to move forward with love.
And on this Sunday, a much larger crowd than usual joined part of the regular route. They included people from the Denver chapter of Run for Their Lives, politicians, and those who witnessed and were injured in the attack. When walkers reached the plaza near the site of the attack, they broke out into prayer and song. A rabbi read the Hebrew names of the victims.
Shoshana bat Lilian Vitet, Eliezer ben An, Shmuel Pesach.
Run for Their Lives organizers also use the event as a stage to reiterate their calls to return the hostages. Videos and speeches by their family members echoed from loudspeakers throughout the plaza. The focus on healing was new for the annual Jewish festival, which usually emphasizes culture. Jonathan Lev directs the Boulder Jewish Community Center.
It was more important than ever to come together and really have a moment to both experience the pain that we're feeling, as well as joy. And those two things are really important to bring together right now. We need it more than ever.
There was a noticeable police presence at Sunday's event. Officers stood in the tight crowd and snipers looked down from rooftops. Boulder resident Rachel Lederman found that distressing.
You can't just celebrate who you are as a person without having to worry about being protected by guns and drones. You know, that's upsetting.
Lederman didn't come to the festival last year, but said it was important to show solidarity after the attack. She said the scene felt joyous, too. Children playing, art displays, food stands serving up shawarma and burgers, and music.
People are being very open and loving, and that's very Boulder.
She went back to a small crowd dancing in a circle, holding hands, spinning, and laughing. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Cohen in Boulder, Colorado.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez.